Welcome to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. I'm your host, Steve Stewart. We're every Tuesday and Thursday, 11 a.m. Don't forget to like us on Facebook at Above the Fold, and you can stream the show live at realtalk93.com. Above the Fold is brought to you in part by Epps Decorating Center. If you're a homeowner, you should always be looking for ways to increase the value of your home, but it doesn't always have to be a major project. A fresh coat of paint can transform the interior and exterior of your home in a dramatic way, and I recommend starting with a visit to Epps Decorating Center, Tallahassee's premier Benjamin Moore paint retailer. Whether you need interior, exterior paint, high-end, or commercial-grade coatings, Epps Decorating Center is ready to serve you and answer all your questions. Stop by today and get a free paint sample to start your new project. Give them a call at 385-6649. That's 385-6649, and we appreciate their sponsorship here. Welcome to our Tuesday edition. You know, I spent the weekend in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm glad I live in Tallahassee. We had a good time, good weather, but again, good to be home here to, as John Cougar calls it, the small town. And so good to be back. I hope you guys had a good weekend. We've got, over the next 2 weeks, a lot of information coming your way. We've got three local meetings next week. And so we're already starting to cover those. The agenda items are out. We're starting to dig into them to see what items are important to you, where they're going to be spending your tax money, what neighborhoods are going to be impacted with projects, and things like that. So it's going to be a great 2 weeks to get all that information out to you. Today, I want to spend some time talking about the vaccine play-to-play state story. A lot of ramifications for this story, and I'll dig into them, but we're going to give you some background on this. 60 Minutes has really stepped into it. And again, in the next segment, we'll talk about exactly what this is, but I think this could have ramifications for media in general, and so we'll talk about that. I want to get you up to date on some local projects that are taking place and some of the nuts and bolts behind those. Rode by the Market District this morning. They have completely tore down the remaining building that was planned to be demolished in the Market Square Shopping Center. So they're hauling away that debris and looking forward to what they have planned there. But that whole Market Square area was part of a redevelopment project before the pandemic hit. And there's a Market Square Park in the plans. It's taken a long time, but I want to give you some of the details on that. They put out a survey trying to find out what amenities should be at that park. We'll go through that survey. Talked about sort of why people go to Market Square in this survey. So some interesting information there. We'll talk about the Appalachian Park out east of town. This is something that Talis Reports has written about in detail, a number of stories. I think this is a great economic development story, public-private partnership, in the sense that they turned a landfill into this cross-country park, which is really, if you look at it, the impact from what we invested in terms of the different events that we have coming is amazing, and that continues. So we'll detail what they have planned for the fall. And just coincidentally, and this is what you're supposed to do when you have a success story like that, is to continue to invest. As I was referencing the number of local meetings next week, one of the items on the Leon County Commission agenda is to spend some money upgrading the park and making it even a better place to hold these events. We'll talk to you about how much money that is and what they're doing out there. And during our last segment, we'll do what we always do, look at some of the COVID numbers, give you a perspective. Breaking good records here in Leon County. So we'll go over those. The state numbers have leveled out in some of the areas. We'll go over and give you the details about that. There was a little bit of an uptick in cases for a couple of days, and now it looks like it's flattened back out. Hospitalizations have flattened, but what I want to do today is give you the reference point to where we are with the numbers currently, and how far back you got to go to get to comparable numbers, so that we can tell you, show you how far we've come, you know, in this COVID pandemic. But pivoting back to what we're going to talk about in the next segment, I'm going to tell you about the vaccine, quote, pay-to-play debacle that is going on in this state. And, you know, we'll talk about the impact or what happened there. But the impact of that story is going to, I think, stretch across the media. And what the story tells you is it tells you the lack of credibility in the mainstream media, in the legacy media. And this is related to 60 Minutes. But I think what's going to happen is after you hear that story, it's going to cause you to raise questions about other stories. And one of those is going to be this narrative that we're starting to see about voter suppression bills popping up all over in states. We are actually starting to see some people come out and say, wait a minute, you know, there are people in high places, and we're talking about the President of the United States. We're talking about other progressives. Actually, we're talking about Barack Obama, who actually came out and encouraged Major League Baseball to move their All-Star game out of Atlanta. But I think what we're going to see eventually, if you can stay with it long enough, is that all the things that they're saying about this election bill in Georgia is going to be discredited in the same way that this vaccine pay-to-play in Florida is being discredited. And what's going to happen is the media is going to lose their credibility over what they've been reporting on the election bill in Georgia, just as they have in Florida. Now, look, the thing in Florida has been going on for a little while, and it took 60 Minutes to really step in it and get it to a national level. So now the question will be, what's going to happen in Georgia to get this to a level where people are going to start saying, people from the other side of the aisle, because that's what's happened here in Florida, and we'll detail that, there are Democrats defending Ron DeSantis right now. So when is it going to come time? What's going to happen in Georgia when you're going to find somebody that is from the other side of the aisle is going to say, wait a minute, you know, people are not telling the truth about what's going on in Georgia and why these election changes are needed. And actually, some of them are enhancements, as I said before, but it's going to be interesting to see when that happens. I predict it within the next 2 weeks that this is going to happen in Georgia, because what's happening is the media, now that Trump is sort of off the stage, they are slowly allowing other voices now to creep in to news organizations or news shows that were originally monopolized by just one side. They've got a problem with ratings because, again, the Trump Twitter has been shut down. So now they've got to pull somebody from the other side. And what's happening is people from the other side, like Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, are starting to make some sense. They're putting out rational ideas about this election bill. And that's going to cause a problem for the mainstream media that has relied so long on the sort of the extreme rhetoric that Trump used to get his points across. And so, again, I give it 2 to 3 weeks, and we're going to see, I think, a little bit of a turn with the way the national media is dealing with this voting bill. And what's going to happen then, just as what's happened with 60 Minutes, their credibility is going to take another hit. And I think it's going to be better for the country as a whole, because then we're going to see, look, maybe we'll start talking across the aisle on both sides and getting to solutions to these issues versus the demagoguery that we're hearing. Now, that type of approach was used in Florida with regards to this vaccine, quote, pay-to-play brouhaha. And so when we get back, what we're going to do is we're going to give you the background in that, tell you why it was an issue, and then how it sort of blew up in the media's face. So stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You listen to the Tuesday edition of Above the Fold. All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. Hope you didn't stay up too late last night watching that basketball game. I know over the weekend there was a classic game, and that's the gamble on watching these basketball games. Some of them get out of hand early and never become competitive, and that's sort of what happened Monday night. But congratulations to Baylor, who won the national championship last night. And actually, first time, I think, if I heard it right, the first time since 1966 a team from Texas won, and first national championship for Baylor. Gonzaga was, I think, the favorite, but never got closer than 10, I don't think, but ended up losing. So put a wrap on that that season and March Madness. So we're off to the Masters, I believe, is coming up this week. And then, hey, football season's right around the corner. All right, vaccine, pay-to-play, brouhaha. If you haven't been following the state news, you know, obviously there's politics at play, and during the COVID pandemic, the, you know, Governor DeSantis took a lot of flack from a lot of different parties in terms of how he was handling the pandemic, which, again, that's part of the process, but some of it obviously was driven by people who want his job, namely the Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. And so anytime, you know, she promoted a narrative, that was sort of what was behind that. And not that Governor DeSantis didn't deserve some critique somewhere, but it seemed like her critiques were always sort of over the top. And then the vaccination was created, and it became about the distribution of the vaccine. And so the critics jumped on DeSantis about the various aspects of his approach to that. And one of the things that started to develop on the vaccine issue from the print media here in Florida was how some of these different groups were getting pop-up vaccination distribution centers. And so this narrative started to develop that these pop-up centers were showing up in wealthy neighborhoods, and they were doing it because, now here's the leap, they were doing it because there were these neighborhoods contained DeSantis supporters, and they had made donations to his campaign. And so then, as they started writing some stories about that, what happened is the word pay-to-play started to get included into some of the narratives. And, you know, pay-to-play is that's a strong allegation because, you know, if you're giving money to a campaign and you're lobbying an official and they decide to go in your direction on a specific policy, you know, that is not pay to play. That's how the process works. Both sides give money through campaigns, and they do that most of the time because they have an interest. They will go see politicians, and then the politicians are supposed to decide what are in the best interest of the community. And if they continually vote against the best interest of the community, they will lose an election. And so that's how the process is supposed to work. Now, if they are getting a personal benefit, personal money, a financial gain from making that decision, that is pay to play. We know it here in Tallahassee because we have had people plead guilty to pay to play in a federal court. So that is a strong allegation. And so the narrative started to center around pay to play on the vaccine distribution sites related to Governor Ron DeSantis. And so it was adopted by Nikki Fried and her group, who was pushing her to run for governor in a couple of years. And so this was the new narrative of trying to take a shot out of or take a chunk out of DeSantis' popularity. And there was story after story. They would go and find the neighborhood that put up a pop-up vaccine distribution center and look for donations in that neighborhood to DeSantis. And so he fought back and tried to tell the media what his defense was. Now, listen, there's no emails saying that DeSantis had asked people to put these pop-up vaccinations up and then to donate money to his campaign. He's not personally making money from this that we have any proof of. So this started to run its course, and it was getting more and more traction in terms of a political issue for maybe a future opponent like Nikki Fried. Well, then enter 60 Minutes, the long-running TV investigative magazine show, and they have butchered this from the very beginning. They have now taken this and revealed what it for what it is, which is nothing but political driven story with nothing to hold it up. And 60 Minutes came down and tried to do a segment. They edited an interview that left out parts of an argument that DeSantis was using to defend himself. And then they actually used the line that DeSantis offered exclusive rights for the vaccine to Publix. And that is excluded. Nobody has exclusive rights to the vaccine. So that is just a complete misstatement, if not a lie. And then they used the famous term, isn't this pay to play? And I think the editing of the video is what most people now are focused on, and also the use of the term exclusive when that is just a misstatement. And everybody is coming out now, not everybody, but obviously a lot of people are coming out defending DeSantis on the national scene. But what has really been interesting to watch is now Democrats are coming to Ron DeSantis' rescue. And this has got to really tick off those who are trying to develop this into a full-blown controversy and take the road down, you know, the conflict of interest road. But the Democratic mayor of Palm Beach put out a press release that basically said that the 60-minute piece was lied on purpose. Now, and they said that the mayor said, listen, I tried to get them. I told them I was available for an interview to tell them that this is not the way it was set up. Publix was the idea of Palm Beach County because 95% of their population lives within 1.5 miles of a Publix. But they didn't want to interview the mayor because that did not fit the narrative that they wanted to promote on 60 Minutes. And then someone, a Palm Beach County commissioner, I can't remember her first name, named McKinley, came out and she had some issues with DeSantis and how he handled the vaccine distribution. But what she did was a worst nightmare for Democrats. She said, I'm not here to talk about the pay to play. And she had some issues with maybe the nuts and bolts of the program. But basically by saying that, she was not on board with these accusations that this was a pay-to-play arrangement. So now we have two Democrats in Palm Beach County defending Ron DeSantis. So they have rescued him from this blown out of proportion controversy. And now the thing is, it's gone national and 60 Minutes has ruined its credibility. It will be interesting to see what happens to the reporter that was responsible for conducting this interview. Obviously, the producers were involved with the editing of the video. But my theory is that this now is going to make even more people suspect the news they're getting from these national outlets. And I think the next place they need to look is the news they're getting in regards to this election bill in the state of Georgia. It's just a matter of time until people start figuring out they're being lied to about that as they were being lied to about this phony controversy surrounding vaccine pay to play. Now, it's been revealed here in Florida and now on the national stage that there was nothing to the story. So how long will it take on this voting bill in Georgia? Look, it's not going to take long because we're starting to see people that are moderate Republicans that aren't Trump supporters starting to say, look, this is ridiculous. They are lying about this bill. And I think it's going to start moving now to include people from the farther left. Because if you are at all objective, you can look at this bill and you can look at the bill in Florida and say, look, we need to make some changes to these enhancements for voter integrity and to increase the ability for people to vote. But this is not Jim Crow laws. It's not racism. There are some good policy issues in these bills. Anyway, we'll see what happens. All right, when I get back, we'll pivot back locally and I'll give you an update on some neat projects going on around town. Stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold. Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere. All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. I'm your host, Steve Stewart. I wanted to clear up something from the last segment, just to clarify, is on the elections bill, I'm not arguing that there's not any issues at all with the elections bill. This is where you work out policy differences and you talk about it. But what's happening with the media is they're calling it a Jim Crow bill. They're calling it voter suppression. And our own mayor here in Tallahassee did call it said there's voter suppression bills around the country. I think those one word or two word synopsis of you know what's happening does no justice to working through some of the real issues in these election bills. I mean, we just came through a pandemic and we had to put in some rules to allow people to have access to ballots. Now, it would be ridiculous to think we're going to continue moving forward with the same rules that we had in the pandemic. For example, they're going to keep some drop boxes. We didn't have drop boxes in Georgia before that, but they're going to tighten up the security. So that's something we need to be able to talk about. So the point being here is, look, we need to get back from yelling at each other and calling bills names and people racist and talking about the specifics in the bill. So hopefully that's the point I was trying to make. Not that this is the bill is the perfect answer to everything. So I wanted to clarify that. All right, moving on to pivoting here locally. Wanted to talk about a couple of local projects. Leon County is going to be hosting a virtual community meetings on this Margaret District Park. And they're going to be April 14th from 2 to 3:30 p.m., April 14th, 6 to 7:30 p.m., and April 15th, 10 to 11:30 a.m. Now, this is about this park in the Market District, which is in the northeast part of Tallahassee, was two retention ponds. They have filled in one of the retention ponds a couple of years ago, and they've been planning to build a park there. Now, first, before we get into the details, the one of the things, too, is this is a virtual community meeting. I don't know how long this is an aside, and we'll get back to the park. But, you know, I had a phone call this morning asking me about when are they going to start these community meetings going to be in person, because this appears to be one that you can only get to through Zoom. Now, I know that obviously the City Commission, School Board, and the Leon County Commission meetings are now open to the public in addition to Zoom meetings. But I think these community meetings need to be open to the public. We need to get out into the community and have people come in and talk to people face-to-face. It doesn't appear to be that, so I'm going to have to check on that to see when we're going to get rid of these virtual community meetings and start having them in person again. But now back to the park. So this park, you know, one of the things when you have a park is what are you going to include with it? And the what they've done here is they did a survey to try to decide what they should do with this park, what people desired for the park. And, you know, it's interesting to see some of the questions because it tells you they did this survey last year. It was 1,200 respondents. And I wanted to highlight just a couple of the comments or a couple of the answers to these questions would show you, give you some information about exactly what's so neat about the Market District. First of all, why do you visit the Market District? The number one response with 71% was restaurants. That's not a shocker. The second one was retail shopping. And the third was grocery shopping. So, and then the fourth, which goes a lot with the first one, is eating and socializing. And those are the first four. And the fifth, which was double digit too, 26% recreation. And that includes walking, running, and biking. And so, again, those are the answers of why they visit. And then the next one is how far do you travel to get to the Market District? And so it's about 70% of the people that visit the Market District live less than 5 miles. So that means 30% are greater than 5 miles, but 70% less than 5 miles, which makes some sense. The Market District is tucked in, you know, between a lot of neighborhoods. And actually some of them people can just walk. And so obviously makes it very accessible for a lot of different people. Now, the biggest question and the last question I'll go over on this is, let's see, where are we here? Give me just a second. It says here, who would you, no, that's not it. The last one, number 10. What are the three elements of a park you would like to see at the Market District Park? Now, again, this area is catty corner to Premier Health and Fitness, next to where the Gordo's restaurant is. And so they're asking this area, which is about 9 to 10 acres, you know, what are the three elements of the park you would like to see? The overwhelming response, 61%, is paths for running and walking. Next, at 51%, is shaded gathering spaces. So that's the only two that were over 50%. 37% was a playground. 36% was water play elements, like a splash pad, like they have at Cascades Park. And then 32% was open spaces. So those are the top five. Now, when you get into the lower ones, you've got things like public art, a dog park with 16%, court games like pickleball, that was 22%. And the very last one is called skatable features, which is 13%. Now, why do I mention that one? Well, because one of the ideas that I think is being floated here, and I'm not sure, we're going to do a little bit more look into this, is a skate park. And I'm not sure what the rationale is behind that, but you know, given the this survey, I think, you know, that is it sort of at the very bottom. So it'll be interesting to see if that comes up in the three meetings that they're having, you know, if this is still, if the skatable park is still an option. And, you know, because this gets back to this whole point about being responsive and transparent about what government does and what actions they take. And so I think this will be interesting to see where they move with what amenities are going to be, you know, be at this park. And so anyway, we'll keep you posted on that. This is going to be, like I said, April the 14th and 15th. So we'll see if we can tune in and see what the, you know, what the comments are and what direction this park is headed. Now, the second park that I wanted to talk about is one that's already been developed and is now is being improved. And that's the Appalachian Regional Park. We've written a lot of stories about this with Talis Reports and how they've taken this landfill and repurposed it and have made this nationally renowned cross-country park where they hold a lot of different events. I mean, I remember talking to officials about this. I mean, there are, they've high school state championships here. They've held college events. And obviously this drives a lot of money to the local area when you talk about runners coming here and spending hotel nights and eating in restaurants. And so this fall, they're going to be hosting 7 major cross-country events at the Appalachian Regional Park. And these events include, obviously, FSU events, 3, I think, FSU events. Let's see what it says here in the press release. It says it's anticipated to bring 35,000 visitors to Leon County and result in $10 million in direct spending. Events include the National Collegiate Athletic Association Men's and Women's Cross Country Division I National Championships, the Florida High School Athletic Association State Cross Country Championships, U.S. Track and Field, Club Cross Country National Championship, and some FSU events. Now, this is really good stuff because this is, again, I think a perfect example of government getting involved and helping create an economic hub, which is helping small local businesses here. It's something that doesn't happen all the time, but this is something that's easily measured too, because you can see the people that are coming. You can calculate the rooms that they're staying in and the restaurants where they're eating. So really a good, a huge asset for Tallahassee. And we need to see sports is a great, people that have kids and that are interested in sports, you know, if it is a well-run operation, they will spend money. Take it from me, because I do that. And it's something that a lot of other cities have focused on and actually have really just laser focused on creating a specific niche for generating economic development. And so that is something we've done here with this Appalachia Regional Park. And again, what we're doing now is at the Leon County Commission meeting next week, they're going to be voting to invest about another $1.4 million into some renovations there. And they're going to use some tourist tax money, I believe, to do that. And so this is an asset that they're going to keep upgrading. And hopefully we'll have more examples of this around town in terms of, you know, assets that take money from the outside and dump it here into local businesses. That's what you want. I mean, that's how you develop economic growth, is money that would have normally not been here from outside of Tallahassee now is coming and is being spent in places that help employ people that live here and help business owners that live here. So it's a really good thing. All right, when we get back, we'll have a COVID update, and I want to talk to you about some records that we're breaking, good records, and we'll finish up some loose ends. So stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold. All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3, our last segment on our Tuesday edition. We'll be back here Thursday. Above the Fold is brought to you in part by Spartan Stoneworks. One of the most common and cost-effective upgrades anyone can make to their home is the kitchen. You're almost guaranteed to increase the value of your home with an updated kitchen, but quality materials like granite, quartz, and marble countertops can get expensive. Well, not when you go with Spartan Stoneworks. Pricing will be lower than anywhere else because they do not mark up the cost of stone materials. The way they see it, since they didn't carve it out of the mountain themselves, they're not going to charge any made-up fees if they did. Great pricing, amazing craftsmanship, and quick turnaround from an honest local company. Call Spartan Stoneworks for any countertop replacement in your kitchen, bathroom, garage, or outdoor space. They do it all. 765-2037. That's 765-2037. We appreciate their sponsorship. Couple of just local news updates. First, you know, I'm hearing behind the scenes that we might have a resolution in the contract negotiations between the PBA and the city of Tallahassee. I do believe that they're going back and forth on proposals, but I understand they are talking, and so it will be interesting. They, you know, been at an impasse. You know, we had the billboards come out with the PBA, and then the fallout from all that, and so hopefully they are back at the table, and it appears that they are negotiating, so we can get that resolved. Another thing is, this is courtesy of Monica Casey at WCTV. FDLE is hosting a press conference, or has hosted. This was 46 minutes ago, on a big drug trafficking arrest called Operation No Warning. Looks like local officials there, and could be as many as 24 arrests. And so State Attorney Jack Hamill says law enforcement and the judicial system did not stop working during the pandemic. There's no question about the correlation of violent crime and drug trafficking. We have a suspect who was murdered during the investigation. So that's good news. As we get back to the post-pandemic world, I understand schools were impacted, but law enforcement was majorly impacted last year by the pandemic and other things. So it can't come too soon with us getting back to being able to do the community policing that we need to do to keep our community safe and take advantage of some of the assets we have here to provide a higher quality of life. So that's wanted to get those two tidbits of news in. Now, COVID numbers. I told you I wanted to talk to you about records we're breaking. Okay, I don't like reporting daily numbers. We like to report trends. And so these numbers that I'm getting ready to talk to you about are trends. This isn't something that just happened and then it's a record. The trend now is obviously has been declining. The 7-day trend for the number of daily cases is at 25, the 7-day average. It hasn't been that low since the beginning of the pandemic back in July of 2020. So continues to go down after a little blip up to 32, which was still the lowest it's been since the beginning of the pandemic. So we're obviously on the downside of this and have been headed that direction since the middle of January. On the positivity rate, we have been below the magic number of 5% since, give me a second here to go over this chart, since looks like the beginning of or the end of February, and we are now, the 7-day average is below 3%. We haven't been this low since they started measuring this positive percentage, or since July or so. Now, hospitalizations, which again, they started the number of COVID patients in hospitals. They started releasing that information back on July 10th. And at that time, we had 56 occupants in local hospitals in Leon County. It reached a height of about 90. Then we came back down to 40 after the first wave, and then reached a high of 150. That was in early February. Well, now we are down to the lowest number, 18, that we've had, again, since they've been measuring it since July. Obviously, this is good news. And again, don't want to sound like a broken record, but you know, when are we gonna? We're starting to see changes in public policy, starting to see changes in the private sector, and I think that only continues unless something major happens here. I mean, obviously, the vaccinations, I would assume, are playing a major role in our ability to get this thing turned around. So these numbers are good. Now, if we pivot just for a second and look at the state numbers, you know, the trends are the same, but the absolute numbers are not as positive. We've had on the number of cases, the very early stages of the pandemic, you know, we're back in July, and you had a 7-day average of around 1,000 cases. Well, we're still at 5,000 on a daily average in cases. Now, the peak we had was in January, which was up to about 15,000. So we're a third of that. The peak of the first wave from a statewide perspective was 10,000. So we're half of that. So we're definitely lower, and the question here is, how low can we get this? Again, if you compare it to how we're doing in Leon, not quite as positive. The same thing on the positivity rate. The positivity rate is not below 5%. It touched that, but it's just above it, between 5 and 7. During the peaks, it was at over 15 on the first peak, and the second peak reached over 15 also. So definitely improvement, but not as good as Leon County. And now if we go down to the number of people in the hospital, during the peak, which was during the first wave, was at 9,500. The second peak in the second wave was at 7,600 in terms of the number of people in COVID beds and hospitals. Now we're down to 2,900. But the only other measurement we have to compare that to is the valley between the peaks, which got to 2,100. So we're not there yet. So again, still a lot of room for improvement on the COVID occupied hospital beds, but we're moving in the right direction. We'll see from a statewide perspective how that continues to move. Here in Leon County, again, just it looks like stellar results to me. I wish we heard more about that from our local leaders. Now, some probably useless information as we leave here on Tuesday, but something that I found in one of the agenda items of the meetings coming up next week, is Leon County is going to be talking about some concurrency issues and the number. And when they do that, they list a lot of different things that they have to upkeep, or they have their responsibilities, and they list the area parks. I think there's 23 area parks that they're responsible for. And the three largest parks are the Chairs Community Park, the Lake Henrietta Park, and the largest park is Fred George Park. And, you know, Fred George Park is 157 acres. The Chairs Community Park is 125. And the Lake Henrietta Park is 127. Now, Leon County basically deals with mostly passive parks. The city deals with housing, the responsibility of having gyms, basketball gyms, and pools at the community parks. And so, but anyway, a bit of information there. They talk about having 667 acres of parks, which is 2.28 acres per 1,000 of the county population. So there's some information you can throw around. But, you know, I don't know that they've been, I wouldn't know by looking at this, the most recent park added, but you know, the park they're talking about in the Northeast would also, I believe that's actually within the city limits. So we'll have to see how that works out. Anyway, all right, thanks for tuning in today with Bo the Fold. We'll be back Thursday with more local and state news. So I look forward to you joining us then. Have a great afternoon. I'm Steve Stewart. Waiting for the